Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We continue this week to examine one of Shakespeare's greatest comedies. There are moments when I'm tempted to think that it is the greatest of the comedies, and it's certainly one of the greatest, Twelfth Night. It exemplifies a pattern, however, that is typical of all of Shakespeare's comedies and will be continued in a new way at the end of his career in the final four plays known as the Romances. And that is a pattern of moving through three phases. This may seem a little bit schematic to simply state it baldly, but we could use a map through the complexities of this play and have a sense of what is going on in the bewildering number of plots, subplots, transformations, disguises, and confusions, all of them highly enjoyable, but nevertheless with the capacity to get us a little bit mixed up. If we back up a little and think of it in terms of an overriding pattern, it is a pattern that, as I say, appears in just about all of the comedies and romances, where we begin with a society that is stable and ordered, but falsely so, in a sterile, negative sort of way. People are unhappy. Often there are binary oppositions between various types of feelings and factions, between people who are in love and who are not in love, who are in love but who are opposed by other people and authorities. There is conflict of social classes. In general, there is a play of conflicting opposites that at the moment are sterile but deadlocked. Then, in the middle of the play, the fun part, there is overturn, something. A monkey wrench is thrown into this system and destabilizes it. And there is a period where all hell breaks loose. Confusion of opposites, confusion of identities, and so forth and so on, reaching a climax. And then in the third phase, resolving into order again, but not just a return to the old order. There has been a benefit to all of this. The society and the individuals have been transformed for the better. That is, as I say, the overriding pattern of, in a way, all the comedies and romances, and certainly of Twelfth Night here. And we have reached Act Four, moving through it act by act. And it's Act Four in which the lunacy, the overturn, the anarchistic chaos comes to a climax for practically all of the characters, but definitely for our heroine, Viola, who has landed by shipwreck out of the sea, disguised herself in the land of Illyria as a young, rather feminine-looking male named Cesario, and is a go-between between Duke Orsino and Olivia, one madly in love, or he thinks he is, anyway, and the other madly negating, refusing love, or she thinks she is, anyway. Viola, disguised as Cesario, moving between them, quickly becoming a favorite, shall we say, of both of them. Both of them immediately begin being attracted to her, even though thinking it's a male that they are attracted to. This would mean, for the Duke, something rather homoerotic, and it seems inevitable that there are overtones to this, not trying to read anything modern into the play at all, but simply what is there in the dialogue. The Duke finds this young man so attractive that he keeps wishing oh, if you were only a girl. Olivia is infatuated with Viola, not realizing that she is really infatuated with another woman. And so we have the gender overturn and confusion. All of this overturn and chaos signified by the festivity of the title, Twelfth Night. Critics use a theory of what's called carnival. Carnival is the period before Lent at the other end of the year from Twelfth Night, which signifies the Christmas season. But the two polar ends of the calendar are alike in having festivals which feature a certain amount of social overturn. In other words, Shakespeare's plots parallel something that is religious and even mythical. And Shakespeare is quite aware of that symbolism in what are called the festive comedies, like Twelfth Night, signifying the 12 days of Christmas and the festivities of Twelfth Night, which are being celebrated by Sir Toby Belch and his crowd of ne'er-do-wells, even though they are aristocratic ne'er-do-wells, Sir Toby Belch and Sir Andrew Aguecheek. And we are having, in general, a lot of confusion going on, which is part of the party atmosphere. As we open Act 4, we spoke last time of Act 4, Scene 1, in which Sebastian, yet another angle of a very complex plot, Viola thinks for most of the play that she is the only survivor of the shipwreck, the only one to come out of the sea. However, she is wrong about that, mercifully, because her brother, Sebastian, has also survived, unknown to her, until the very end. And he has now entered Illyria, which greatly increases the confusion because they are identical twins. And when Viola is disguised as a male, they are impossible to tell apart. This always makes for a bit of ingenuity and probably poetic license on the part of most audiences in most productions. How do you get two people to look exactly alike on stage or even in film? But we accept it as part of the convention that these two literally, when they come together, as they will, of course, in Act 5, look absolutely identical. Therefore, Sebastian walks in and Fest, the clown, thinks it's Cesario. And Sebastian says, I don't know you. And Fest thinks, oh, well, goody for you. You're trying to out-clown the clown. Well held out in faith. No, I don't know you, nor I am not sent to you by my lady to bid you come speak with her. Nor your name is not Master Cesario, nor this is not my nose. Nothing that is so, which, as I said last time, could stand for a motto for all of Shakespeare's comedies and romances, at least in this anarchistic phase of their common plot. But at any rate, the identity confusion is due to the fact of the identical twins. And the fun continues because before the scene is over, Sir Andrew Aguecheek comes in. He has just been on the verge of trying to fight an abortive duel with Cesario because he foolishly thinks, he's deluded into thinking he actually has a chance at being a rival for Olivia. He doesn't, but he thinks so. And due to the way the duel went, with Cesario obviously afraid because it's a woman in disguise and she doesn't know how to fight a duel, he is emboldened. He's a coward. But now that he thinks that he's fighting an even bigger coward, he's going to boldly accost him. So he walks up and strikes Sebastian, thinking it's Cesario. Much fun. Why, there's for you, he says. Sebastian is astounded and says, why, there's for thee, and there, and there. And he beats Sir Andrew with the hilt of his dagger and says, very explicably, are all the people mad? Where in the world did I wash up? Sir Toby steps in to this and tries to restrain Sebastian, and Sebastian won't have it and draws his sword. Sir Toby, who may be a drunk, but he's not a coward, unlike Sir Andrew, who's a total coward. Sir Toby does draw, and they begin to fight, interrupted by Olivia, who is furious with her relative, Sir Toby, for daring to threaten her poor dear Cesario. Oh, be not offended, dear Cesario, and dismisses Sir Toby and Sir Andrew, and says, oh, come with me to my house, and makes much over him. And Sebastian is even more astounded and says, or I am mad, or else this is a dream. The theme of madness, when the order of things begins to break down and opposites begin to get confused. By one definition, that's madness. Normality, sanity is a social consensus. This is this, and that is that. And when that breaks down, we fear that we are going mad, or we think someone else is going mad. Twelfth Night was written right next door to Hamlet and the theme of madness, and who sees what runs through that play in a tragic tonality. Here, Sebastian, he's a laid-back enough guy to say, or I am mad or else this is a dream, but if it be thus to dream, hey, let me keep sleeping. So he goes with it. There's suddenly this beautiful woman who's fawning all over him. All right, if I'm asleep, I'm going to stay asleep and enjoy this. Move to Act 4, Scene 2, where Malvolio is going to be tormented by Sir Toby's crew, led by the clown Fest. They have shut him up. He has been pronounced by Olivia herself, the poor man must be mad. Go treat him somehow. Not being very specific and giving them license to do pretty much whatever they want with a man that they in fact hate. Malvolio is constantly trying to crack down upon their festivities, and now they have him in their hands, and they're going to torment him in a way that gets perhaps a little bit out of hand, but is fairly elaborate. They shut him up in a dark room so that he can see nothing. He can only hear them through some sort of alcove or doorway. And Fest, the clown, dresses up and begins to act a double role. So we have yet another person in a disguise who is one person and yet another person, that which is and yet is not. The play begins in binaries that are absolutely mutually exclusive, what William Blake would have called a negation. This opposite cancels out this opposite. Now we move into the middle period of what some critics call liminality, a period where things are somehow shifting and one thing turns into another thing, or is both that thing and the opposite thing. And that's exactly the mechanism, as Freud discovered at the turn of the 20th century, exactly the mechanism of dreams, in which one thing turns into another thing, or one thing is another thing at the same time, either displacement or condensation, to use the Freudian terms. And this is a very dreamlike experience where things are not themselves and yet they are. And again, the theme not only of dream but of madness. Again, they are going to tell Malvolio, you are mad. And the ringleader is Sir has, who is Fest. Fest dresses up as a cleric. Why a cleric? Because the theory, at least the theory that the play is going on for the sake of the plot, the theory is that madness is caused by some sort of demonic possession, and therefore this has basically got to be tantamount to a kind of exorcism going on here. So Fest dresses up as a cleric and begins babbling all sorts of what is supposed to be taken for theological high-toned abstraction. It's really just a bunch of gabbling nonsense. Bonos dies, Sir Toby. For, he says, as the old hermit of Prague that never saw pen and ink, very wittily said to a niece of King Gorboduc, that that is, is. Very profound. That that is, is. However, in the context of this play, in which, as we just saw in the scene just previously, Fest saying nothing that is so is so, now we have that that is, the direct opposite of it. Again, the questioning of reality that's going on. And they are going to attempt to make Malvolio doubt his own sanity. They are going to do what nowadays has been given a name, gaslighting. He is in the dark, and the first thing they tell him is, well, now see, that is definitely a symptom of madness, because he keeps claiming, please do not think I am mad. They have laid me here in hideous darkness. And Fest, playing his role of exorcist, the house exorcist, basically, says, oh, fie, Satan. You think the house is dark? Why, it hath bay windows transparent as barricados, and the clerestories toward the south north are as lustrous as ebony, yet thou complainst thou of abstraction? It's totally light in here. You think it's dark. You see, you're just not right in the head. And he goes on to say, I say there is no darkness but ignorance, in which thou art more puzzled than the Egyptians in their fog. The Egyptians, meaning that this is a reference to the Exodus in the Old Testament, which is interesting, because we have the plagues of Egypt, one of which was, yes, a plague of darkness, and a passage through the sea, through the Red Sea, and a rebirth on the other side, the Hebrews reborn after passing through the Red Sea as the Israelites, the chosen people of God. It's the same pattern. And goes on with, again, what you can simply dismiss as joking gabble, but this being Shakespeare, has a double and probably a triple meaning. Okay, we have to quiz you. You claim to be sane, but you certainly do seem mad. What, for example, is the opinion of Pythagoras concerning wildfowl? To which modern audience says, what? Well, Pythagoras believed in reincarnation. The place that an Elizabethan audience would have known Pythagoras is not from Pythagoras's own writing, which he belonged to a very early pre-Socratic period of Greek philosophy, and there's very little left behind from that period. Where an Elizabethan audience would have known Pythagoras is from the speech of Pythagoras in the end of Ovid's Metamorphoses, a book that compiles 200 stories of Greek mythology about metamorphosis, one thing changing into something else. And at the end of it, Ovid drags Pythagoras on stage in the 15th and last book to give a long speech about reincarnation, because the Pythagoreans did believe in reincarnation, but it's really about much more than that. It's about how, whether or not there's supernatural reincarnation, or karma, as the East might call it, there is change, there is metamorphosis, not just in these strange stories of Greek mythology that I've been telling for 14 books, but change and metamorphosis all around us, even in our own bodies. He imagines Helen of Troy in her old age, looking in a mirror, wondering about the face that once launched 1,000 ships, now old. Metamorphosis. So, what is the opinion of Pythagoras? And Malvolio answers correctly that the soul of our grandame might happily inhabit a bird. Grandma might be reborn as a bird. What thinkst thou of her opinion? I think nobly of the soul and no way approve his opinion, Malvolio says. Well, Fest, the cleric, says, remain thou in darkness then, for thou shalt hold the opinion of Pythagoras ere I will allow of thy wits. We're going to make you believe that dark is light and that your grandma is a waterfowl. In other words, this goes far enough that it begins there. It has the potential, depending on how it's staged, to get a little uncomfortable, because the man is obviously distraught and terrified. He's a jerk, and we know that, and he deserves it in a way. And yet it gets to the point where he's so terrified that we're a little upset at his traumatizing. But we see what's going on here. He has been put in the position, rather ominously to us, of Orwell's 1984, where people are coerced into saying that 2 + 2 = 5, because anything that the regime says, you say, yes, sir. And he is tormented by Sir Topaz. That is the name of the cleric. Why Sir Topaz? Because Topaz was a gem that was supposed to, more folklore, supposed to cure madness. And we leave poor Malvolio stuck in this distraught position. And we go to scene 3 in Act 4. Enter Sebastian with a pearl. This play has an amazing number of signifiers, objects given to other people, often jewels given. We remember that Olivia gave a jewel to Cesario. Now she's with Sebastian, though she still thinks it's Cesario. She has not been yet unconfused by that, and has given another gift, given a pearl. This pearl she gave me, Sebastian says when he comes on stage, and though 'tis wonder that enwraps me thus, yet 'tis not madness. Oh, it's not madness, but there's wonder. Wonder is a recurrent Shakespearean word for the thing that happens, the transformation that is mysterious and yet wonderful. And Sebastian has an instinct, an intuition here, that for though my soul disputes well with my sense, that this may be some error, but no madness. This is too good to be madness. And so I'm going to trust it and go with it. End of Act 4, and we enter Act 5, in which all of the characters that have been separated, so much of the confusion has been because characters can be confused as other characters because they are never seen together. Finally, for the first time, everybody's going to gather on stage in Act 5 in a grand climax. And in fact, Act 5 is one big scene. What critics, going back to Aristotle, would call a recognition scene. Aristotle in the Poetics spoke of anagnorisis or recognition. He spoke of it in terms of tragedy, where at the end there is a recognition of the true tragic state of affairs, but it can happen in comedy and perhaps even more so. Here at the end, it's all going to be recognized, but not before the mistakes and mistaken identities reach an absolute crescendo of what seems like madness to the characters and is absolutely hilarious to the audience, of mistaken identities and just plain mistakes, period. And this begins with the coming together of Antonio in front of Duke Orsino. Antonio, more reminder of things we spoke of last week, is the friend of Sebastian. They both escaped from the sea and are best of friends together, but Sebastian, in disguise, has gone on ahead. Antonio, however, has been arrested. He entered looking after Sebastian, or hoping to, but taking a grave risk. He's doing it out of loyalty and friendship, but in fact he's a wanted man in Illyria because he engaged in a sea fight at some point in the past against Orsino's ships. He claims here, well, I wasn't being a pirate, but it's really kind of courtroom double talk because it sure sounds to us like he was being a pirate. But in some altercation between his group and Orsino's ships, in which in fact Orsino's nephew lost a leg, so it was not just kid stuff. But anyway, I wasn't being a pirate, and anyway, I saved this ungrateful wretch, and Antonio points to Cesario, in other words, Viola, because he had stepped in the abortive duel between Cesario and Sir Andrew Aguecheek, and got arrested because his cover was blown by doing that, and Viola pretended, as he thought, not to know him. In other words, betrayed him, and he is cut to the quick, angry, bitter about this. I saved this wretch here. And again, the answer he gets, outraging him, but truly is, thy words are madness, more madness. More people enter together. Olivia enters, which means, since Orsino is already there, that for the first time in the play, these two, which we have known to be an item, at least in Orsino's mind, from the very first lines of the play, but they have never met for five acts. Orsino has been mooning over Olivia from afar for the entire length of the play. This is actually the first time they are together in the play. And Olivia definitively rejects Orsino to his face. And, okay, Orsino says, well, if that's how you feel about it, I can at least take my revenge by taking my trusty servant, Cesario, here with me. I know that you've come to like him. Well, he's mine. Come away with me. And Viola starts going with him, which outrages Olivia. She thinks that she has already had a relationship with Sebastian, and she still thinks this is Sebastian, Cesario. It's very complicated. She thinks, however, she's been betrayed. And the priest who happens to be there swears that, well, you know, in fact, I married these two just a few hours ago. And at that, Orsino explodes furious. Now he thinks he's been betrayed by Cesario. So both of them have suddenly turned on Cesario, in other words, Viola, out of mistaken identities. And we learn that offstage, Olivia and Sebastian have actually gotten married. Now Sir Andrew Aguecheek bursts in, and he accuses Cesario also of having basically beaten the crap out of him, not realizing that that was Sebastian. And by this point, after 30 minutes, I hope the audience is still following all of this. It's really complicated. It would go better on stage when you can actually see it. It's easier to follow. But verbally, you get the idea of the amazing, confusing complexity, all orchestrated by Shakespeare, all reaching a crescendo here to be resolved. Right at the moment, for this exact moment, the whole world is accusing poor Viola. We remember the imagery of bear baiting. Orsino's name means bear. The Elizabethan pastime of tormenting a poor bear. And she is in a tormented position, strangely mirroring that of Malvolio. She has done nothing to deserve it, and in fact, she's the most deserving person of the play. Malvolio was, in a way, getting what's coming to him, but we have two characters who are being baited, who are being turned upon, and it is at its absolute worst, right at that exact moment. Enter Sebastian. And he makes a speech, and if I were directing a production of Twelfth Night, at that moment, I would have, he hasn't quite realized, he hasn't looked across the stage to see that he has a double on the stage. But he makes a brief speech, and at that moment, I would have the entire action stop dead and totally silent, staring in utter amazement, maybe for as long as about 10 seconds, which is a long time on the stage, because they're all dumbfounded, but this is the moment of transformation and of recognition. This is the moment, and Orsino bursts out with the following lines: one face, one voice, one habit, and two persons, a natural perspective that is and is not. Opposites have become one. What is and is not. Northrop Frye's book on Shakespearean comedy and romance, if you read one delightful, accessible book on Shakespearean comedy and romance, I would recommend it, is called A Natural Perspective. That is and is not. And Antonio bursts out, not quite so mystically or lyrically, says to Sebastian, how have you made division of yourself? An apple cleft in two is not more twin than these two creatures. Which is Sebastian? How have you managed to clone yourself? There are two identical people. This is his best friend, but his best friend has to ask, which is Sebastian? Sebastian suddenly realizes, seeing Viola, says the stage directions. Do I stand here? I never had a brother. I had a sister whom the blind waves and surges have devoured. Of charity, what kin are you to me? He is beginning to realize, but it's too much to believe at the moment. We have to try to confirm this. And basically, Viola shows her ID, so to speak, tells things that only his sister could know, and realized that the brother and the sister have both survived, and that Cesario is Viola. And wow. Suddenly, the whole world reorganizes, because now the deadlock on romance in the main plot has suddenly seen a possibility for absolving itself. And a damn good thing, too, because as Sebastian points out to Olivia, you would have been contracted to a maid, he says. Luckily, I came in out of the water, and I'm available for you. So, Olivia gets out of her, I'm going to stay in mourning for 7 years nonsense. Find Sebastian, and they will. They are already married, as a matter of fact. Orsino gets his not-so-secret wish, really. He has been walking around saying, really, it's kind of too bad you're not a woman, because I really like you. And what that has done is enabled them to form a genuine relationship instead of his courtly love at a distance nonsense. He's actually fallen in love for someone because he knows that person and likes that person genuinely for who they are. That has been the whole purpose of this. Instead of this illusory romance stuff, which is all in his head, he's come to love a real human being. What the gender of that human being is, does that matter that much, really? And there is good grounds for speculating that Shakespeare himself may have been non-binary, bisexual, attracted to both males and females. At any rate, he is clearly thinking about gender identity and what you will, that word in the title that in Elizabethan parlance means desire, what you desire. And those couples are now sorted out. And we have some promises on the part of Sir Toby's crew of reforming a little bit. We don't have Malvolio to enforce it, but we do have Malvolio to deal with. Malvolio is brought on stage one last time, absolutely outraged, and when Olivia learns what has been done to him, she really says, okay, this went too far. I didn't intend for you to torment the man. And she does say, well, this may rather pluck on laughter than revenge, but she does give Malvolio a promise that he will get some recompense out of this. He was mistreated, she agrees, and she will do a little bit of punishing here. But Malvolio will not accept. He will not be folded into the happy ending. He chooses anger and revenge instead. He is the refuser of festivities and says, I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you, and stalks off the stage. Some people can't be included in the happy ending and the reconciliations and the weddings. Not because the group excludes them, they exclude themselves. And that's that. And the play ends with a strangely melancholy song sung by Fest. When that I was a little tiny boy, with hey ho the wind and the rain. And it has the chorus of the rain, it raineth every day, and it runs through a whole life and always ends with the rain raining every day. A great while ago the world begun, but that's all one, our play is done, we'll strive to please you every day. The last opposites to be, rather transformed and confused, are the merry and melancholy opposites that we saw as being confused and conflated, also in Much Ado About Nothing. Here, this very comic play ends with a sad song, which is somehow, in a way below reason, the right way to end it. We will try to draw all the themes together a little more in our next episode, and then we will go on to a new play. I'm trying at least to get an example in of one of Shakespeare's multiple types of plays. We'll move from a festive comedy to the so-called problem comedy, Measure for Measure, next time.